We're ready to proceed.
Your Honor, Matthew Osofsky, appearing on behalf of Hunter Industries. The closing party in this case has requested the appellate argument, and therefore I would request to reserve my time for rebuttal.
You're the appellant?
We are the appellant, Your Honor. If you would like me to present first, I will certainly do so.
If you don't present anything, you don't get any rebuttal.
Ah. I do apologize. I have on previous occasions reserved entirely for rebuttal. That was my anticipation today, but I'm more than happy to alter.
Well, you are the appellant.
Yes, we are.
Okay, well then we're here to listen to what you have to say.
Thank you, Your Honor. Judge Lichtenstein, Judge Webb, Judge Fox, may it please the court. This case involved a case that went to trial and on which my client prevailed. The unchallenged portion of this case is that my client performed work on a construction project for which they were not paid, for which they were entitled to be paid. They received a judgment in that regard. However, Hunter Industries was not able to obtain its full compensation out of this because a partner in the enterprise, Brett Matthews, had been dismissed prior to trial. The dismissal was of Mr. Matthews, Brett Matthews, there's several Matthews involved in the case, was improper because the pleading set forth that Mr. Matthews was an owner of this business, that the law of the case had been established very early in this case, that the corporate status of Matthews Custom Homes LLC, or LLC status rather than corporate status, was an open question in the case. As early as February of 2010, Judge Leo Montgomery issued an order, which is at the record, it's the relevant portion of which is at the record at page 77, in which Judge Montgomery discussed at length that whether or not Matthews Custom Homes was entitled to any recognition as an LLC or not was an open-ended question in the case and would be determined in the case.
How does that implicate your argument that, and I'll just say Fred because of the multiple people with the same last name, how does that ruling have any effect on your theory that Fred was a general partner in a partnership?
Factually or legally?
Legally.
Legally, it's the law of the case that what was to be determined in this case was a declaration regarding whether or not the LLC was entitled to any recognition as such or whether in fact it was a general partnership. In fact, Judge Montgomery used that exact term. She questioned whether or not this entity was a general partnership.
And that's at record 77?
That is record at 77 on her decision. It was from pages 3 to 4 on her decision.
And she referenced the possibility that this entity and its individual participants was simply a general partnership?
Correct, a sole proprietorship or a general partnership. She speculated as to both. She further stated that the allegation of personal liability on the parts of the defendants for breach of contract under the relevant case law, specifically Sheffield v. Trowbridge, presented that the question of a declaratory judgment of the corporate status was inherent within the complaint. And in fact, all the case law runs in that direction in terms of notice pleadings. The issue in the notice pleadings is not how many legal theories you attach, how many lists of claims you attach. The operative question within notice pleadings is, what facts did you allege? And if there is a legal theory which provides for relief under the facts you have alleged, then you're entitled to present it. And that is the status of notice pleadings law within the state of Colorado. The desire to present a case as to Fred Matthews' relationship to this entity was both inherent in the supplemental complaint, and if it were not so, it was expelled out ad nauseum in the response to the motion for summary judgment.
In your response to the summary judgment motion, did you ask the court for leave to amend to assert a partnership theory?
We asked the court that in the, as a alternative position. What we stated to the court was that our desire was to present these full scopes of claims to the court at trial, and that we felt that each of these claims was present and inherent in the supplemental complaint, and if it were not so, that the appropriate remedy were to allow amendment rather than to proceed to summary judgment. We did not make an explicit motion for leave to amend, and we did not do so at that point because our position was very strongly that these positions were inherent in the complaint.
Is there any reference to partnership liability in the fourth or fifth claim for relief?
Is there any reference to partnership? No, there is no specific reference to partnership liability. There is reference to Fred Matthews' ownership interest in the business.
What do you have the document handy?
I do not have the document directly in front of me. I believe that we cited within the brief. In fact, I know we cited within our brief directly to the place within the supplemental complaint, which we identified Fred Matthews as an owner of the business.
Okay, I will look again. Thank you.
And I'd be happy to check that and provide it to you on rebuttal time as well. In addition, Your Honor, I'm not sure that it entirely matters whether Fred Matthews is a partner within Matthews Custom Homes or not, because the ultimate question here is, what was Fred Matthews' legal relationship to this enterprise? And this is, the enterprise I'm talking about is the course of investments in building three homes. Whether Matthews Custom Homes existed as a separate entity or not, Fred Matthews had a relationship to this transaction. And his relationship to this transaction can only be described as a partnership. He says he was not a shareholder. He does not claim he's entitled to any protection under any type of corporate shield. He is clearly not a lender. He had no promissory note. He was entitled to share in profits. His relationship to this enterprise, whether we characterize Matthews Custom Homes in one way or another, was as a partner to this enterprise. And as a partner to this enterprise, he is liable for the contracts of this enterprise.
Well, Mr. Osofsky, I understand there's an affidavit where Fred said that he made a loan, or it was in his deposition testimony. And so my question for you is, what evidence was there showing that there was a genuine issue of material fact on that piece?
As to whether it was a loan?
Right, and so therefore was he a lender?
There's extensive testimony cited in the brief on that subject. When asked about what a loan was, Fred Matthews couldn't identify what a loan was, what differentiated a loan from other types of investment. He could not describe what the shareholder agreement that had his name on it was even meant to do. He couldn't describe, he said he was entitled to profits, but he, in essence, Fred Matthews is a layperson who has no cognizance of the distinction between an arm's length lender and somebody who shares a different relationship to the transaction. So his lay representation, I was a lender, one was self-serving within the legal construct of the that they were in at the time, but two, it was really a statement of a lay person of, I was just loaning my son money. But legally, the relationship that created was one of partnership, because Fred shared in the profits. He also shared in the overhead expenses. This was not simply, I'm loaning you money. When the construction loans came due and they were unable to pay them, Fred directly paid a portion of those construction loan installments for the company. And so his relationship was in no way related to being a lender. He also personally guaranteed the construction loans. No arm's length lender is personally guaranteeing other loans. There's nothing about this relationship that in any way reflects an arm's length lender. This was a relationship in and among family members, very loosely defined, that legally it can only be defined as a partnership. The fallback position that we had, first and foremost, if Fred, if this court determines that we are entitled to bring forward our claim as to whether or not Fred Matthews was a partner in this enterprise, then largely the rest of the issues are somewhat moot, because there's a direct liability that flows through for all of the damages that were issued in that case. But if that is not the case, we are still entitled, there is still an additional error, we are still entitled to proceed on theories of violations of the trust fund statute. We're entitled to recovery under the stolen property remedies available under the trust fund statute. In addition, the trust fund statute allows for constructive trust. And this is the issue that was parsed out in, I believe it's in Ray Allen, and I apologize if I missed the citation. At any rate, the distinction here between constructive trust and remedies under the stolen property statute are not that one is available and one is not. One is available under the trust fund statute. One is available under the stolen property statute. Stolen property statute has specifically delineated remedies that say that we can reach the money regardless of whether Fred Matthews was a bona fide purchaser for value. The trust fund statute allows for constructive trust, which would allow us to reach the money with Fred Matthews if he was not a bona fide purchaser for value. And he was not. And he was not under the terms of the agreement as he understood. Fred Matthews was unjustly enriched because he testified directly in his deposition that he was not entitled to be paid out of this project until all the subcontractor obligations had been satisfied. So the value he was entitled to receive was not the value he did receive. So he's not a bona fide purchaser for value. So we're entitled to remittance under both a constructive trust issued under the trust fund statute, which public policy is very clear on the purpose of what that trust fund statute, and it is to remedy this exact type of situation where money is being effectively sequestered by a general contractor with a family member to frustrate the interests of a subcontractor, the valid interests, and is unquestionably valid interests of the subcontractor.
Mr. Osofsky, can you clarify for me, are you merely arguing that counts 4 and 5 were improperly dismissed, or are you saying there were other claims before the court with regard to Fred?
What I am saying is that within counts 4 and 5, there was a direct statement of that Fred was unjustly enriched. That unjust enrichment, and let's deal with that in terms of count 4, that an unjust enrichment statement, and combined with the request for a constructive trust, allows the trial court to consider whether or not the flexible remedy of remitting this money to my clients from Fred Matthews is permitted. And that is regardless of whether or not Fred Matthews was personally distributing the money. Constructive trust is a flexible remedy in that regard. So within count 4, we would characterize count 4 as being a request for a constructive trust under a theory of unjust enrichment. As far as count 5 goes, count 5 is a recipient of stolen property. That is the statutory remedy, and that reaches Fred Matthews regardless of whether he is a bona fide purchaser for value or not. The judge's order in dismissing that claim essentially said that if Fred Matthews didn't have scienter on this, that he could not be held culpable. That's not the case at all. We can reach to someone who is, in fact, even a bona fide purchaser for value, let alone someone who is not culpable. And in fact, in remarriage value makes that explicitly clear. The court went to lengths to reach the money that had gotten to the wife. There was no question whether the wife had any scienter for the embezzlement that occurred prior that wound up with the funds in her hands. She was not culpable for the embezzlement. Regardless, her lack of culpability did not prevent the court from reaching out and remitting the funds from her under the stolen property.
Counsel, didn't your client have a remedy in terms of being able to attach a lien to these homes where he did work on those? And wouldn't that lien have given Fred Matthews notice that there remained a contractor that was not paid?
Yeah, that remedy was available, and that remedy should have been used and was not used, and it likely would have solved a great deal of problems. But the case law within Colorado is abundantly clear that a lien is not a predicate to a trust fund claim in any way, shape, or form.
But what about Fred Matthews having noticed that there was still money outstanding? What notice did he have?
Notice is not an element of any of the considerations within the stolen property statute, Your Honor. Like I said, even a bona fide purchaser for value, which is somebody who certainly would not have noticed that the property had been stolen, is subject to remittance under the stolen property statute. So notice is not the element here. In addition, Your Honor, I think the court has to consider that this is a privity relationship. This is a relationship amongst family members. To the extent that Brett was left ignorant as a partner in this enterprise of an unpaid entity, really is not an issue that lies with my client. That's an issue that lies in and among his partnership with his sons and daughter.
Following up on Judge Lichtenstein's question, does your constructive trust remedy or your stolen property disgorgement remedy go beyond the basic debt of approximately $27,000?
That's an issue that has not been resolved at the trial court and has not been briefed to this court at this point, Your Honor. I see I'm out of time. If I may complete my answer.
Well, let's take it a step at a time. Are you asking for more than $27,000, approximately, whatever that number is, more than the actual amount of the unpaid debt from Brett?
If he is indeed liable as a partner, he's liable for the full judgment.
How about as to your constructive trust / unjust enrichment / stolen property claim?
I don't know,
Well, what are you asking for? You asking for the $27,000? You asking for the approximately $100,000 that was distributed to him?
At the trial court, if this is remitted for the trial court's consideration, we would request the full amount. As to whether or not the legal entitlements spell out that we're entitled to the full amount at that point, I believe the trial court's going to have to resolve that before this court can consider that question.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And I apologize if I caught you by surprise. It's just my sense of our practice is that the appellant can't come in and say, well, I'll rest on the briefs and I'll reserve everything for rebuttal.
Your Honor, I find that when I come in here, depending on the panel, it's different each time. But I appreciate the opportunity to present to you today, and thank you very much for your time.
Okay. You can run the lectern up there. Things are working.
May it please the court, I'm Bradley D. Hill, registration number 9423, appearing on behalf of Fred Matthews. I'll probably call Fred.
If please, that's all right. That's just easier for everybody.
Counsel for the Hunter has discussed a few things. I'd like to tell the court just a few facts to clarify a few things. This case was originally brought by Hunter against Matthews Customs Homes, Inc., Rick Matthews, and Lisa Matthews back in 2009. Fred was not even involved in the case when Judge Matt Montgomery issued her order. He was not involved in the case until May of 2011. There were three claims brought against the Matthews defendants, or MCH defendants as we used to call them. One was for breach of contract, one was for unjust enrichment, and the third was for breach of the trust fund statute. This case lingered for several years. And finally, in May of 2011, Fred Matthews was brought in this case for the sole claims of a breach of trust fund claim. If you look at the record, the trust fund briefing by the plaintiff specifically said that was his claim against Fred Matthews, a trust fund claim and a theft claim. And those are the two claims, the only two claims brought against Fred Matthews. The record is replete with comments by counsel for Hunter that Fred didn't even have standing on the contract claims. That's in a case management order, that Fred did not have standing even to defend against those claims. The second pretrial order was that it was specifically limited The two claims against Fred Matthews were limited to the trust fund claim and the theft claim. There's no evidence in the record that Fred Matthews was ever charged with the breach of the contract claim or the unjust enrichment claim, which is a quantum merit claim that only exists if there's not an express contract. And so the only two claims against Fred Matthews were the fourth and the fifth. Plaintiff never argued in the lower court that one, two, and three were subsumed into the fourth and fifth claims, and did not argue that in front of the trial court in the motion for summary judgment. In fact, what it asked for, and this court asked counsel for this, he asked for a declaration in his motion for, in his response to the motion for summary judgment, that as to what the status was. There's no reference whatsoever in any of the pleadings that Fred Matthews was a partner. Now, this case started, so what I'd like to do, just the fourth claim was that Fred violated the trust fund statute. Now, that's where you have to start this whole process. To violate this trust fund statute, you've got to show that the owner or the member of the corporation, this is a corporation, not an LLC, this was a corporation, and the case law is very clear that you have to show that the person had financial control or made financial decisions of the corporation to hold either the officer or the shareholder liable. That's under Alexander Packard, the Reagan case, the Barnes case. Fred presented an affidavit, several affidavits, and documentary evidence to show that he did not have financial control and did not make the financial decisions. And that was submitted to the court with its motion for summary judgment. The plaintiff did not respond and file any countervailing affidavits or documents under that. And so under Brown and Keenan, and Continental versus Keenan, and Closed Basin, the court basically essentially said he's abandoned that fourth claim and granted summary judgment, and that was proper.
Okay, now, but you're characterizing the fourth claim as Fred being a direct participant in violation of the trust fund, correct?
The fourth claim alleged that Fred was a shareholder in Matthews Customs Home, Inc. It did not allege any partnership whatsoever. It said Matthews Customs Home, Inc. Yeah. He was an owner in that company, meaning a shareholder.
Okay, but why wouldn't the plaintiff have a constructive trust remedy if there was a trust fund violation, even if Fred was, you know, innocent of the violation itself?
For two reasons. First of all, there wasn't, and I set forth in the brief, and I'll discuss that in the part five, but there was not a trust fund violation at the time Fred was repaid his portion of his loan. There was not a trust fund violation at that time.
Why not? Second,
because there was plenty of funds in the account at that time. What we have to do is separate out. There were two properties. One was 1085 and one was 1260. Fred's involvement was really only with 1260. That was what he got money from, the sale of 1260. 1085 is a separate issue. The plaintiff has consistently tried to bring those two together. 1085 is a separate issue. 1260 is the one where when it sold, it received $197,000 worth of proceeds. And Fred was paid $112,000 of that. There were other checks for $60,000, leaving $22,000 of the net proceeds. And the documents in the record show, that in addition to that $22,000 that was put into the bank account at that point in time, there was another $20,000, so there was about $40,000 after the payment to Fred, his loan repayment. There was $40,000 in there.
And the lower court never got to that point because it tossed the trust fund claim on the statute of limitations?
Well, the trust, they never got to that issue.
Okay, so I guess my point is, if we were to reverse in whole or in part the statute of limitations ruling, there would be various factual questions as to whether there had been a trust fund violation.
Well, I set forth in my brief and in the lower court, in there, because it was bifurcated, this thing, the summary judgment, in the motions for summary judgment, there was evidence both presented by Fred Matthews of checks written after the...
Okay, let me try to make this clear. In your summary judgment, did you make the argument you're making now that if you trace the funds, there could not have been a trust fund violation because there was ample money in the bank account to pay off the subcontractor when Fred got his remittance?
I didn't make that specific argument, but under the Dandridge versus Williams case, a United States Supreme Court case, it specifically says that the prevailing party in a summary judgment can argue any grounds, even if that ground was not relied upon by the court. And I cited Dandridge in the opinion. And that goes for the theory of summary judgment. It's to test the material, whether there are material facts and the intrinsic merits of the case. Well, here, the only facts to show that there was a trust fund violation are the plaintiffs, are the Matthews Customs Homes financial statements, and you know, the bank statements. The plaintiff put those into evidence in his response, in his motion for summary judgment. They were in front of the trial court, and they're in the record here. Those bank statements, those monthly bank statements, are the only material evidence to show whether a trust fund violation occurred. And under Dandridge, we are allowed to look at that, even though that specific request was not raised at the trial court, but we're allowed to look at that because we were the prevailing party. Those bank statements and the checks that the court was had in front of clearly show that at the time of Fred's repayment, there was plenty of money in the account to pay, and you have to look at, we have to again bifurcate. There was plenty enough money to pay both accounts, both claims, but Fred's money was only from $1,260. That claim was $7,700. And so...
Okay, were there other unpaid creditors of the corporation at the time Fred got the $115,000?
There were a few, but what the record shows is after Fred's payment, there was $60,000 paid, and then there was $40,000 left. The next month, there was even enough money. The next month,
okay, so
through December of 2009, there was enough money to pay the $7,000 on just $1,260. There was also enough money to pay $1,085. Plus, $1,085 had not even been sold yet. $1,085 was sold, and there was $49,000 put into the court for that for that case.
Okay, so my question is a little more narrow. When Fred got his payment, $115,000, whatever it was there enough money in the bank account at that point to pay off all the subs?
Yes.
Okay. And that's clear from the summary judgment record? I mean, the bank accounts are only going to be half the equation. You also have to have in the summary judgment
record. Yes, there was enough money to pay them.
Okay.
And so a different result would not accrue if this court remanded this issue down. Now that the other question is where the motion, the plaintiff never made a motion to file a leave to add these additional claims. The court did not abuse its discretion in denying that in granting the motion for summary judgment. He denied that request to file an amended complaint to add those additional
claims. You're saying expressly or implied?
Pardon?
Expressly or
well,
impliedly?
I think both.
Are you saying there was a motion to reconsider this denial of summary judgment, and in that motion there was an expressly request for leave?
There was never a motion for leave to amend at the complaint. There was never even a case management order or a trial management order. Excuse me. The defendant was never on notice that these claims would be brought until a motion for summary judgment was issued. Was filed.
You clarify when you say these claims? Because we have a supplemental complaint with claims 4 and 5.
Yeah, so. I'm talking about any kind of a claim for partnership, any kind of claim for quantum merit, the unjust enrichment part, and any claim for corporate distributions. Those were only alleged in plaintiff's response to my motion for summary judgment. There was never any, and the court did not abuse its discretion. It discussed those, and it denied the leave. The case law, Lisio, talks about that. There's several cases, Lisio and another case, that talks about if the court can impliedly reject it, there's another case that talked about it as well, but that I cited in my brief. But the court denied the request to file a leave for amend and to leave, to add these additional claims. They were inconsistent claims with what plaintiff had alleged all along in the fourth and fifth claims. They were inconsistent. Aiton, the case law, Aiton talks about that. A good time rental talks about delay in filing a motion, the bad faith in this case. The plaintiff says that he never felt he had to file this place, yet file the amended complaints, yet he says in all the filings in front of the court that Fred was never charged with a violation of the breach of contract or an unjust enrichment implied contract or a partnership. That was never discussed in any of the, in the trial management orders, in the motion for partial summary judgment. He did not, that's the most telling part. Plaintiff filed a motion for partial summary judgment on the contract claim. He did not allege in that claim that Fred was a partner or on the contract. The only thing in that motion for partial summary judgment, he asked for determination of law that Fred disgorged his monies. And Judge, I'd like to respond to what I think I didn't need to respond. There is no case law, absolutely no case law, that says a recipient of money from a construction contract is entitled, that a constructive trust can be imposed upon the recipient of the money. What the constructive trust is, and Alexander talks about this versus Packard, the constructive trust is imposed upon the person who violates the trust fund statute. And that's where this led. You've got to first find a violation of the trust fund. And then if that person violated the trust fund, a constructive trust can be put on that person. But not, there's no case law, and that would be expanding the mechanics lien statute way down the road to impose a constructive trust upon a recipient. There is absolutely no case law to that. Allen is not on point on that. Allen is a theft case, solely a theft case. Allen doesn't even talk about a constructive trust. He talked about that they had an equitable lien. There's a lot of conversation in Allen, but if you look through it, it's a trust, it's a theft case. First, you have to have a theft. And first, before that, in a trust fund violation, you have to have a trust fund violation, and then a theft, and then it goes down to the third lower element.
Doesn't the trust fund statute create a presumption that there is a civil theft?
No. Aiton talks about that. Aiton says that you have to prove all of the elements of the theft case. And Aiton's cited in the brief, I-T-E-N. It says you have to prove all of the elements. So there's three elements you have to prove. You have to prove that there's a trust fund violation. Then you have to prove a theft. And then you could perhaps, after that, go to the Allen constructive trust. But that's not, that was misstated. It's not a constructive trust. It's an equitable lien.
Well, let me ask you a question with regard to claim five then, which was based on 18-4405. Does Fred need to be the person committing the theft, or could he still be liable if Rick, Lisa, and MCH were liable?
The claim seemed to imply that Fred was the person, and that's what the lower court looked at. But again, looking at Williams versus Dandridge, the first thing that they have to prove is that there was a trust fund violation by someone. Then they would have to prove theft, and each element of theft, and there's two elements of theft that talk about scienter, and Ivan talks about that. And then you would have to go to the remedy, which is what talks about in Allen, but you don't get there because there was no trust fund violation.
Thank you.
I think I'm out of time.
Yes.
Thank you.
We appreciate the arguments of both counsel. The case stands submitted. We will issue a written opinion in due course.